all this maniacal madness. Get rid of the people! Save the Earth!
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 16 of the show. Well, Dave, I'm glad we didn't have to listen to any more Jordan Peterson Bible lectures for this episode.
Yeah, agreed. He's finally stopped popping up on my YouTube suggestions, and I'm pretty happy about that.
Well, I still keep seeing Peterson's mug when I get on YouTube. But yeah, I don't think I could listen to even one more of those Bible lectures. They were such a mess.
I think it's the most true idea I know.
Yeah, they were important episodes to do, but I'm glad to move on. Definitely glad to move on.
Yeah. Dave, on the topic of our prior episodes, I was recently talking to one of our listeners, and she had taken her daughter to see the new Frozen movie. Mm. And she said that it has many excellent examples of the sorts of worldview subversion elements we discussed in earlier episodes. So maybe we should get Anna to do a deconstruction of that show at some point.
Yeah, good idea. I've seen the trailers, and I'm sure it looks like a train wreck, so we should do that.
Yeah. Today, our plan is to dig into paganism.
Yes, paganism. And actually, this topic naturally flows out of our discussions of Jordan Peterson, since in the Bible lectures, he was actually promoting paganism.
So let's get into the topic.
Hey, Dad, don't forget the mail.
Oh, yeah, we can't forget the mail, Dave.
We got
Well, since our last episode, we received a wonderful email from our dedicated listener, Mavros. Dave, take it away.
All right. So, dear Dan and Dave, Mavros writes, I've been enjoying your show for some time now, especially the recent focus on Dr. Jordan Peterson and exposing his true beliefs. I believe that your show is providing an important service to Christians. Related to this, we should not forget just how many of the letters of the New Testament are actually similarly intended as warnings, identifications, and instructions on how to deal with false teachers within the church, as well as those who attack the church. So, yeah, thanks, Mavros. You know, the Jordan Peterson episodes were certainly a heads up and a warning for our Christian audience, but hopefully they were interesting enough to also keep our non-Christian audience listening as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he continues by pointing out, and I'm going to summarize because there's a bunch of in this emails. He continues by pointing out that 1 hour a week on Sunday morning does little to combat the indoctrination that we face all week, especially in our left-leaning, increasingly socialist public school system. And we would agree with that, I think, eh, Dan?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, and in fact, that's why we go to the effort to do these shows, to expose all the various forms of worldview indoctrination that we're exposed to every day.
And Dave, I think that's a cue for our jingle.
This is the Not Conformed Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
So Mavros goes on to comment and ask about socialism and Marxism or communism, which has come up on the show from time to time. And I think we'll save his main comments for a future episode on that topic. And we definitely plan to do an episode or even episodes on Marxism and socialism, because those ideas seem to have gained a surprising amount of traction in our society with our politicians and even among Christians. Many people think that they're being progressive and globally minded and conscientious about the poor and the less fortunate, and they don't realize what they're really spouting is Marxist ideology. So thanks, Mavros, for your input and your encouragement, and rest assured that Marxism is in our crosshairs.
Indeed it is, and thank you, Mavros.
That was an awesome email!
Okay, let's start our discussion of paganism with a clip from a lecture given by law professor Stephen D. Smith.
Okay.
This is a lecture that covers material from Smith's recent book titled Pagans and Christians in the City, Culture Wars from the Tiber to the Potomac. And by the way, this is a book that I highly recommend. And in this clip I'm about to play, we'll hear Smith expanding a thesis that was put forth by the famous poet T.S. Eliot, mm-hmm. a thesis which Eliot presented in a series of lectures at Cambridge in 1948. Listen to this.
Eliot argued that the future of Western societies would be determined by a contest between Christianity and a rival that he described as modern paganism. I believe, he said, that the choice before us is between the formation of a new Christian culture and the acceptance of a pagan one.
Wait, what? He's saying that the main societal conflict in the West is between Christianity and paganism? That sounds odd. Didn't paganism die out in the West sometime in the late 4th or early 5th century, after the Roman Empire became mostly Christian at the time of Constantine? Well, Smith goes on. Listen to this.
The problem with this thesis, it may seem, is that it comes too late, by about 2,000 years. Eliot's diagnosis might have been apt for the Roman world of late antiquity. At that time, paganism and Christianity did constitute the principal alternatives, or at least so we may suppose, with the benefit of hindsight. Christianity is thought to have prevailed in that struggle, so that from the late Roman Empire through the early modern period, Western peoples lived under what we often describe as Christendom. But history's moved on. Today, the live alternative to the Christian ordering, or the successor to it, is not a pagan society, it would seem, but rather a secular one. This historical paradigm in which the West has moved in progressive stages from classical paganism to Christendom and on to modern secularism is well entrenched and by now almost instinctive with us. We almost automatically refer to it, for example, in understanding our current cultural struggles. So conflicts over marriage or abortion or education or religious freedom are often seen as pitting traditional religion and religious ideas and constituencies against progressive secular and progressive ideas.
So a common view is that the main cultural conflict in the West is between Christianity and secularism or progressivism. And maybe, Dave, let's define secularism and progressivism so that we're all on the same page with regard to these terms.
Sure. So this is an entry in Wikipedia on secularism, and it reads this way. Secularism, as defined in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, is the indifference to or rejection or exclusion of religion and religious considerations. In certain contexts, the word can refer to anti-clericalism, atheism, desire to exclude religion from social activities or civic affairs, banishment of religious symbols from the public sphere, state neutrality towards religion, the separation of religion from state, or disestablishment, which is separation of church and state. So, and then as a philosophy, secularism seeks to interpret life on principles taken solely from the material world without recourse to religion.
Yeah, so it's excluding religion from societal activities. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah, so that would be secularism. And then the other one we want to define is progressivism. And again, here's from Wikipedia. Progressivism is the support for or advocacy of social reform. So it definitely has to do with social reform, social engineering. And it continues, as a philosophy, it is based on the idea of progress, which asserts that advancements in science, technology, economic development, and social organization are vital to the improvement of the human condition.
Yeah, so the idea here is that there would be continual improvement if we apply the scientific principles. We can continually improve in terms of things like equality and well-being, and ultimately we can reach some sort of a utopia.
Yeah, and so remember Jordan Peterson, the thesis that he was advancing, at least maybe this is the way he was spinning Nietzsche, was that Christianity had failed to materialize or to produce any further advancements, and so we had to then move on to science and technology and all this kind of stuff. And you bring the utopian ideals, and one of the things that we have to remember is that it was always under these utopian ideologues, like under Marxism, where we end up with the most heinous crimes against humanity under the guise of, you know, social reform and progress. So progressivism in my books is not a good word.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Even though today everybody wants to be progressive and labeled as progressive.
Yeah, even the conservatives want to be progressive in Canada. The progressive conservatives.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, good point. So anyways, just going back to what we were talking about before, I think a common view in many circles is that Christianity and religion in general is dying or dead, and secularism and progressivism is winning the culture war.
Yeah, and hence why some Christians and some of our listeners are very worried about the reemergence of communism or Marxism, views that partly fit with, or at least dovetail with, secularism and progressivism, as we've noted. You know, Dave, roughly 10 years ago, when a series of books came out penned by the, I guess we could say, vociferous and irreverent and even crotchety atheists, the now notorious Richard Dawkins with his book, The God Delusion, and Christopher Hitchin with his book, I think it was called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisoned Everything. And we can also add Sam Harris, who wrote The End of Faith. At that time, one might have thought that the movement signified by these publications, the so-called New Atheist Movement, was the last nail in the coffin of religion in the West. And, you know, when I look around and with tumbleweeds blowing through near empty churches and the public education system left thoroughly bereft of any Christian content, the outlook for Christianity seemed very bleak. And so the prospect of a secular worldview dominating the landscape was almost a foregone conclusion, at least maybe 10 years ago was in my mind. But listen to this. Smith goes on.
Now, it's true that by now most observers will admit that religion hasn't declined as decisively as had once been anticipated. And it may even be that the triumph of secularism is not as inevitable as was once thought. Even so, those are the viable alternatives: Christianity, or religion more generally, and secularism, not paganism.
So while the new atheists might not have been as successful as they had wished, Smith argues that people in the West still consider the main culture war to be between Christianity and secularism. But T.S. Eliot and Professor Smith suggest that framing the present cultural battle in terms of a Christianity versus secularism debate doesn't explain some of the main cultural conflicts in Western society. Instead, they suggest that a different dynamic is at play, one that has been bubbling under the surface of culture for a long time, and which was simply masked by the intermittent bloviating of the atheists. And importantly, the argument, Dave, is that the culture wars are better understood from the vantage point of Eliot's thesis. Here's Smith one more time.
Mm-hmm. At the outset of his lectures, Eliot explained that he was advancing his unconventional interpretation in response to, quote, immediate perplexities that fill our minds. He declared as well his suspicion that the current terms in which we discuss international affairs and political theory may only tend to conceal from us the real issues of contemporary civilization. As it happens, I have a similar suspicion. For example, to me, and I'm hardly alone in this, the secular versus religious interpretations of current culture war conflicts increasingly seem inadequate. Eliot's suggestion just might offer a more illuminating way of understanding what's going on.
So, the common view is that in the West, there is a cultural war between Christianity and secularism. But Eliot's and Smith's view is that this might not really be the best way to look at things, and that a better way to conceptualize the state of affairs is in terms of a struggle between Christianity and paganism.
Dan, the reason I find Eliot's and Smith's thesis intriguing is that it's consistent with much of the material we've covered in prior episodes of the show. And you think about the growing advocacy for psychedelic drugs and then shamanism and the pagan psychoanalyst Carl Jung and how his work is being promoted through Dr. Jordan Peterson's teachings and the emergence and popularity of the Marvel and DC cinematic universe, which openly promote the pagan gods and shamanism and magic and on you go. Right.
That's right. Yeah. And we'll get into some of these topics as we talk about paganism. But Dave, before we go on, I should say that I do consider the Eliot Smith thesis to be a bit of an overstatement. I think that secularism is still a player in the game, at least for now. And so, as we said, we'll spend more time in future episodes dealing with secularism and Marxism and so on. But I certainly agree with the Eliot Smith thesis in that the Christianity and paganism conflict is a critical and often overlooked dynamic.
Yeah, and it's it's not just Eliot who had this idea. You'll also find this idea a little earlier in the poet Yeats, specifically in his poem, The Second Coming. And by way of background, William Butler Yeats was an Irish poet and one of the foremost figures of the 20th century literature. And he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1923. At least that's what Wikipedia says here. So so I came across this analysis of Yeats' Second Coming by Greg Johnson. And I first came across it in Vox Day's book, Journadetics, when we were doing the Jordan Peterson episodes. And I'll put the direct link in to the Countercurrents article to this analysis. But this is what Johnson writes. He says, as I read it, there are three distinct stages to Yeats' narrative. The first is the age when Christian values were the unchallenged core of Western civilization. This was a vital, flourishing civilization, but now it's over. The second stage is nihilism, both active and passive, occasioned by the loss of these core values. This is the present day for Yeats and ourselves. The third stage, which is yet to come, will follow the birth of the rough beast. Just as the birth of Jesus inaugurated Christian civilization, the rough beast will inaugurate a new pagan civilization. Its core values will be different than Christian values, which, of course, horrifies Christians who hope to revive their religion. But the new pagan values, unlike Christian ones, will actually be believed, bringing the reign of nihilism to its end and creating a new vital civilization. For pagans, this is a message of hope. So that's Greg Johnson commenting on Yeats' Pagan Second Coming, and it's from countercurrents.com, and I'll put the link in the show notes. So I think this idea is kind of becoming popular. It's all over the place, and I think that Smith plugging into it, there's some validity there.
Yeah, I agree, Dave. And so over the next few episodes, we want to unpack all of this in more detail. And to do this, we'll have to spend some time discussing paganism. And consistent with Eliot's and Smith's and Yeats' thesis, I think that as we cover the main themes underlying paganism, we'll see that we might get fresh insights into some key societal trends and some ideological conflicts in the West. Okay, so what are some of these trends and conflicts I'm talking about? Well, I think we'll get fresh insight into why Christianity singled out as being particularly distasteful to non-Christians in the West. And maybe we'll come to better understand why magic and polytheistic themes seem to dominate modern media, particularly the movies and popular novels. And then there's the environmental movement, which seems omnipresent in the media, you know, with these images of lone, emaciated polar bears floating on shrinking icebergs everywhere.
That's right. That's right. And Greta Thunberg, or some call her Doomberg. Greta Thunberg. Telling us, you know, that we only have 10 odd years left before climate Armageddon.
That's right. Yeah, and another issue that we might illuminate a little bit, maybe the cultural wars regarding public symbols.
That's right, particularly if you think about the removal of Christian symbols from public places and events. All across Europe, they're taking down crosses out of ancient Christian cathedrals. And you've got, in Canada, you've got the removal of the Lord's Prayer. You know, when you and I, Dan, were growing up, we'd recite the Lord's Prayer in the morning after the anthem. And that's gone, right?
Yeah.
And this is happening in various ways in the U.S. as well, the taking down of displays of the Ten Commandments, and on it goes.
And perhaps chief among the issues that will be illuminated in our discussion of paganism will be issues related to sexuality, including the wider societal acceptance of homosexuality and abortion, and the growing rejection, or at least devaluation, of monogamous marriage.
Yeah, and sadly, there's also the looming specter of transgenerational sexuality, as they as they like to call it, and pederasty or pedophilia, which also factors into things.
Yeah, and in addition to all of that, in the next few episodes, we hope to get into pagan magic and witchcraft and alchemy and the occult and ecstatic practices, which are all re-emerging on the scene with adherents advocating for these practices with newfound vigor and enthusiasm. But today we want to start discussing paganism by touching on some of its key religious and philosophical themes, and by exposing how some of the pagan themes are manifesting in our current Western culture.
So I suppose we should start with a rough definition for paganism. And we've been throwing the term around, so perhaps it's time to nail it down a bit.
Well, as it turns out, it's not that easy to nail down a definition of the term. Here's a little history offered by historian Robin Lane Fox in a book titled Pagans and Christians. And this was published in 1986. And this is almost a classic textbook in this area. Mm-hmm. But on page 30, he writes the following. In antiquity, pagans already owed a debt to Christians. Christians first gave them their name, Pagani. The word first appears in Christian inscriptions of the early 4th century and remained colloquial, never entering the Latin translations of the Bible. In everyday use, it meant either a civilian or a rustic. And then later he adds, Pagani were civilians who had not enlisted through baptism as soldiers of Christ against the powers of Satan. By its word for non-believers, Christian slang bore witness to the heavenly battle which colored Christians' view of life, end quote. And then he also adds, paganism, in quotes, too, is a Christian coinage, a word like Judaism, which suggests a system of doctrine and an orthodoxy as Christian religion knows one, end quote. So according to Fox, the term refers to the religious practices of those who were not either Christians or Jews.
Again, as an aside, in the ESV, the word pagan pops up several times, especially in 1 Corinthians. And I'm thinking, you know, of the passage where Paul says, you know that when you were pagans, you were led astray to mute idols, however you were led. And so when you look it up in the, I've got several of these dictionaries, the Erdman's Bible Dictionary, for example, says mm-hmm. pagans, a designation for non-Christian Gentiles in contrast to the Christian Gentiles addressed by Paul. And what's really happening here is that in the New Testament anyways, it's the Greek word that's often translated also for Gentiles. It's ethne or nations or Gentiles. And in a few passages, it comes back as pagans because the concept is already there. It's even there going back into the Old Testament to distinguish the foreign adherents of heathen religions. And then when the empire becomes, certainly the Western church becomes predominantly Latin, you get this term pagani or pagan as we know it. But the concept comes before it's this Latin introduction.
Yeah, and it's basically referring to the beliefs that are other than the beliefs in the Judeo-Christian God, Yahweh, and it does go all the way back. Now, of course, it's important to keep in mind that there were virtually no people at the time who were atheists. And maybe the closest would be the Epicureans, though they weren't exactly atheists. And so, yeah, the term paganism can be thought of as referring most specifically to any non-Judeo-Christian religious practice known to Christians in and around Rome, but also before that and after that as well. Now, it's important to keep in mind, mm-hmm. because we're going to spend some time talking about Rome, that at its zenith, at its peak, in about AD 100, the Roman Empire stretched from Britannia, now England and Wales, and it included the western parts of Europe as far east as roughly what is currently the Czech Republic. So that's where we're from. The Roman Empire surrounded the Mediterranean Sea and parts of the Black Sea. It enveloped a sliver of northern Africa that was heavily populated, including Egypt, and it contained parts of the Middle East. And it extended even to Mesopotamia, which is the region around the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, presently known as Iraq. So the Roman Empire was absolutely massive. And so the religious and spiritual traditions that might have been known to the early Christians and to which they might have referred to as pagan might have included the religious practices of the Europeans, who were mostly the Celts, the Greeks, the Northern Africans, the Egyptians, and the Mesopotamians. And we could say that mm-hmm. the Christians might have also been aware of some of the religious practices of Arabia and the Far East and refer to those religious practices as pagan as well. So I guess in the broadest definition, paganism includes all non-Judeo-Christian indigenous practices all over the world across time. And I always struggle to think about how Islam fits into that. What do you think, Dave? Does Islam fit into this category? Is it a special thing or how would you treat it?
Well, I would say in Islam, you have, it's a different kind of a beast. Islam is essentially a Christian heresy, if we want to call it that. I think we should, because Muhammad is actually reacting to the Jews of his area and the Christians of his area. Many of them probably, an historian banished into those areas. And so he is reacting to them and supposedly a corrective to them. But there's also an interesting connection is that Allah, according to some scholars anyways, is Muhammad picks just one of the deities in his polytheistic temple of his, the nomads, the Arab nomads there. And he picks one and he becomes the supreme deity of Islam. So there's a pagan connection there, I think, as well. But yeah, so I wouldn't put it in the same place. Yeah, yeah, I wouldn't put it in the same place. It's certainly not in terms of the kind of practices we're going to talk about, because even though you got this huge geography that we've outlined, there is, and you got different practices, the practices vary here and there. There is a coherent set of concepts that we'll see, not necessarily a theology, but a certain set of concepts and practices that unify the world of paganism. And we're going to go through those, I think, throughout this episode here.
Yeah, that's right. And I should add here a quote from Robin Fox, who does say, this is our historian, quote, "So many overlapping and coexisting cultures make general description of paganism extremely difficult," end quote. But certainly, Dave, as you say, nevertheless, there are some common themes that run through paganism that are worth discussing, if for no other reason than to see how they're emerging in our culture today.
That's right. And remember, if we're talking about Islam, this is much later than the origin of this term, because Islam, we're talking into the 7th century, right?
So that's right.
So it's also a different beast just from the chronological perspective as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's start talking about the different aspects of paganism. And we should begin with polytheism, the worship of more than one god, which is one of the hallmarks of paganism. And in the Roman world, and even before and after, people accepted and worshipped a gaggle of gods, a multitude of gods.
That's got to be our episode title, A Gaggle of Gods.
A gaggle of gods.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, for example, the ancient Mesopotamians, located around the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers in the Middle East, which would have included the Babylonians, by the way, and other groups as well. Well, they had many gods, and some of which came and went over time, and others which changed. Some examples are Apsu and Tiamat and Marduk, and also readers of the Bible might recognize Dagon as one of their gods. And then we could go to the Egyptians, and they had many gods as well, including Osiris, the god of the underworld, Isis, goddess, wife of Osiris, Ra, the sun god, Horus, sun gods all over the place. But they had many other gods as well.
Yeah, and you think about the Greeks, right? They're also polytheistic by definition. Indeed. According to Greek mythology, you've got Uranus, the sky god, and Gaia, the earth goddess. And they give rise to a generation of gods known as the Titans, and I guess we could say Titanesses as well. And then you got the Titans Kronos and Rhea. They give rise to the Olympians, and the most well-known of which is Zeus. And then the Olympians overthrow the Titans, and they rule from Mount Olympus. So you got the whole soap opera of the Greek gods, right? So then you got the Romans, who adopted many of the gods of the nations they conquered. And so the Roman gods were often versions of other gods, but mostly the Greek gods. And so you've got Jupiter, who's also Zeus, or Juno, who's also Hera, or Minerva, who's also Athena. Those are the main three there, the chief ones. And then we find Neptune, who's also Poseidon, and Venus and Aphrodite are the same entity, and then Mars and Eris are the same entity, and Apollo, he keeps his name, and then Diana and Artemis are synonymous, and Vulcan and Hephaestus are synonymous, and Vesta and Hestia and Mercury and Hermes and Ceres and Demeter, right? And so this is what they do. And so in addition to polytheism, we should probably introduce a couple of other concepts. And one of them is syncretism, and the other one is henotheism.
Okay, tell us about these, Dave.
All right. So syncretism is the concept of borrowing gods from other cultures, right? So they're pulling in, they conquer and they pull in the other gods. Now, henotheism is a little bit different. It's the belief that a god is known by other names in other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So the Romans might conquer someplace and say, A, these are the gods we don't know, and so we'll add these to our pantheon, and B, these are the gods that look similar to the ones we already know, and so we'll just add their local names to the names that we already have for them.
Right, so hence, like Jupiter and Zeus, for instance.
Yeah, all those synonyms that I just mentioned above, right? And so yeah. Henotheism, and I'm getting this, this is according to Dr. Ryan Reeves, and I'll have a couple of his clips later on. Henotheism is the idea that one god might show up in another place and he's going to manifest himself slightly differently than in some other place. And this was they considered this the purview of the gods, right? To kind of display, show a different face over here and over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you could say it was a doctrinal or a philosophical assumptions that they made. They expected to find this.
Mm-hmm.
And this wasn't done to accommodate the locals or condescend to the locals, but it was a way of subjugating them, to subjugate their gods into the Roman pantheon.
Yeah, hence the ever-expanding Roman pantheon of the gods.
Yeah.
But Dave, you know, as I read about the pagan gods, I noticed that they had some more or less common traits. So for instance, I noticed that many of the gods have regional jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
So they are gods of a specific city or of a specific nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I also noticed that they have specialized abilities. So for instance, some gods, they can affect fertility. Other gods are responsible for war. Others have maybe specialty over certain elements like water or wind, right? So they have specialized abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe thirdly and critically, the gods have certain mortal qualities to them. So for instance, they can die or be injured or be imprisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have the war of the gods, the Olympians and the Titans, and there's imprisonment and so on. And actually in the Mesopotamian myths, you've got the killing of various gods by other gods. So they have these mortal qualities.
Yeah, that's right. And there's another distinction we should make, and that's between the main civic gods who had these public worship places who were supported by the elites, and that they're the gods of the cities, as you mentioned, or even wider areas. And then the household gods, which were much more personal, mm-hmm. but still involved in kind of the daily ritual of the typical pagan Roman.
Yeah, and when it came to these household gods, people would have images of these gods in their homes. They would have statues and shrines,
mm-hmm.
and yep. they would make their little, they would have their devotions to these gods in their homes. And according to Fox, women were required to adopt the god or gods of their husband's family. So when they got married, they mm-hmm. had to ditch their own god and pick up a new god.
Well, and you go into a new place, right? So the gods yeah. of that place apply. And I remember the story of Rachel stealing her, in the Old Testament, stealing her father's household gods as they're, you know, they're heading out.
Don't take my gods.
Yeah, well, that's what he was ticked off about the most, right? He wasn't ticked off that he was taking his daughters away. He was ticked off about the
taking their gods away. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess we should add that for some pagans, almost every part of nature and every location had its own deity or god. And, you know, water had its god, the moon had its god, and so on. So lots of god for yeah. lots of things. Yeah. So, okay. So the big question, though, for us is, how is polytheism coming back into Western society today? And first of all, there's obviously an increase in people migrating to the West from areas of the world in which polytheism is practiced. And so, of course, these people bring their polytheistic beliefs to the West. But also mm-hmm. Westerners themselves, who find foreign gods and beliefs compelling, who are, we can say, xenophiles and are attracted to exotic yeah. gods, also bring these various gods and myths to the West and practice polytheism in the West.
That's right. I mean, when you think about we've talked about shamanism, right? So that's Central and South America. The ideas of shamanism are filtering into our culture.
Mm-hmm.
From the Caribbean, we've got voodoo spiritism is definitely filtering into our culture. From Africa, we've got ancestor worship, filtering into our culture in various ways.
Yes.
From, you know, Japan, China, that Asian area, we got Shintoism and Confucianism and their spiritual ideas. And kind of there's a lot of spiritism going on there. And then from India, we've got the Hindu and the Buddhist deities, right? And also from Asia, the Buddhist ideas. So all these things are coming into the West. And as you say, those xenophiles, the people that like these foreign ideas, are propagating them very actively and very kind of, I would say, evangelistically into our culture.
Yeah, Dave, as an interesting example of gods migrating to the West and popping up in some unexpected places, we can consider CERN, that massive particle collider. Yeah, that's on the French and Swiss border, which has a statue of the Hindu god Shiva on its main campus.
Yikes, yeah.
I have a clip here from a video about Shiva put on by the British Museum. Listen to this.
Mm-hmm. Light, water, and fire are essential to human life everywhere. And everywhere, people use their constantly changing forms as symbols for other worlds, for beliefs, for as means of reaching and connecting with supernatural forces. A figure that wonderfully brings together all of these elements is the image of Shiva Nataraja.
That wonderfully brings all this together is the image of Shiva. She's so excited.
Wait, that's right. I mean, and it's this evangelistic gushing over this deity who this is a goddess of death or something like that, or well, god of death, isn't she?
Yeah, well, listen to this. Yeah, she continues here enthusiastically.
One of the great symbols of the Hindu traditions.
Woo!
Shiva here is shown dancing, bringing the world into creation. He's surrounded by a ring of fire, which has so many practical and important uses, but also is destructive. In his right hand, he holds up the drum of creation. Around another of his right arms, he has a cobra ready to spit and poison. But his hand is up saying, don't be afraid. Under his feet, there is a figure being trampled down. That is ignorance. His hair is flying out to the side, reminiscent of the sacred waters of the Ganges. But Shiva can also destroy. And this constant energy, this constant dancing, which brings the world into existence, which keeps it going, which cuts it down, is a wonderful, wonderful symbol, which is so evocative of the energies of all life, that it's used at the CERN Nuclear Physics Center in Switzerland as a symbol for how science is trying to understand the subatomic particles that are the very basis of matter. And so outside CERN, there is a wonderful sculpture of Shiva Nataraja, the shadow of which at night is cast over the entire building, because this is the energy of the particles, the dance of the particles that make matter and life possible.
Yeah, the dance of cosmic creation and destruction is one article puts it here. I'm looking online about this. This is not good.
It's crazy, right? What is Shiva doing at a scientific institution? But the way this British woman from the British Museum or whatever sold it, I have to play this clip, Dave.
So that's a pretty mind-boggling idea. Like, seriously, that's a mind-boggling idea.
That's what I was thinking when I was listening to her tell me about how awesome Shiva was.
Yeah, it boggles the mind.
Yeah, it's a good example of, you know, these gods making their way into the West.
That's right. And you just reminded me of a very recent development here where there's a statue of Molech, the pagan deity of child sacrifice, displayed at the Colosseum. So this is from an article from now through March 20. So this is from a mid-November article. From now through March 2020, as part of an exhibit celebrating the city of Carthage, a giant statue of Molech, the god of the ancient Canaanites and Carthaginians, will greet visitors at the entrance to the Roman Colosseum. So remember from the Old Testament, this was the god that they sacrifice your children to.
Yeah.
Right? That was condemned by, that's why the people were destroyed by God in the Old Testament. So this stuff is all filtering back and people are gaga over it, not realizing what they're bringing with these entities.
Or are they realizing it, Dave?
Yeah, maybe. Well, I mean, there's a purpose behind installing these statues, right?
Yeah.
They're popping up all over the place.
Yeah, they might be very aware of what they're bringing into town. But Dave, polytheism is also making a comeback through the movie industry, particularly through the Marvel and the DC cinematic universes. And I know this is regularly your beat, but...
Yeah, you're walking on my beat here.
I know, but...
I saw the clips.
Yeah, I have an example here from the DC cinematic universe movie, Wonder Woman. And Wonder Woman is a god-human hybrid, or she's some sort of a semi-divine being raised by a group of warrior women called the Amazons. And here's a clip from the movie Wonder Woman in which one of the Amazon women is describing to Wonder Woman, and her in the movie, her name's actually Diana, describing the history of the Amazons.
Long ago, when time was new, and all of history was still a dream, the gods ruled the earth, Zeus, king among them. Zeus created beings over which the gods would rule. Beings born in his image, fair and good, strong and passionate. He called his creation man, and mankind was good. But Zeus's son grew envious of mankind, and sought to corrupt his father's creation. This was Ares, the god of war.
So here we have essentially a creation myth being told, and it includes the old gods. You've got Zeus, right? And then you've got Ares, and you've got man being created, and the corruption of man, and so on.
Yeah, that's right. And you'll notice that this isn't the exact, this is a retelling of the story spun in a certain way to send a certain message that the actual writers of the Wonder Woman movie want to convey. And that's another problem with this whole thing is that it creates, that there's no authoritative truth in this at all. There's just... I don't want to say it. There's no canonical version of the story. You can retell this in all kinds of ways as long as you get the basic names of the entities right. Whatever message you want to bring in, go for it. Right? That's quite destructive from a Christian perspective. Which, as Christians, we consider history to be important in terms of it, us getting it accurate and right.
Yeah, because it's concrete
to the truth of history. Right? That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course, again, we're it's polytheistic in the sense that we already hear about a bunch of gods. Let's listen to a little bit more of this clip.
Ares poisoned men's hearts with jealousy and suspicion. He turned them against one another, and war ravaged the earth. So, the gods created us, the Amazons, to influence men's hearts with love and restore peace to the earth.
So you notice it was the Amazons, the women that were created to save man.
Yeah, that's right. And if you know anything about the background of the concept of why the author who created Wonder Woman did it, it's got a very feministic, that was the whole point of it, is to bring a feministic message to his audience.
Yeah. Dave, should I keep playing it or do you think we should just move on here?
Well, we can move on. It's people can listen to it.
It just goes on like that for a while.
Yeah.
Well, I have another example, again, from the DC universe, and this has to do with the movie Aquaman. And here's a clip describing a mystical and powerful trident Aquaman is to procure.
This is the lost trident of Atlan.
Oh, I know the story.
It's more than a story. It's real.
It's real.
It was forged by the greatest weapon masters in history.
crafted from Poseidon steel for King Atlan, the first ruler of Atlantis. Legend says the trident was imbued with the power to command the sea.
Yeah, notice the magical trident. And what's it made from, Dave?
Poseidon steel.
Yeah, and who's Poseidon?
As the Greek god of the sea,
the
or
sea, water, or something.
Sometimes even, well, the sea, and there's also chaos or that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's very interesting, Dave. In that clip, he says, no, it's more than a story. It's as if what they're trying to tell the audience is, yeah, you guys all think that these are just all made up, but in actuality, they're not. Right. So it's like they're preparing them to grow in their faith in these old stories, these old pagan myths.
Yeah, definitely. And it's if the secularism has conquered theses as true, then why are people just lapping up these stories in the movie theaters that essentially bring that message, right? That rebrand the ancient gods, especially in the DC cinematic universe. And when at the conclusion of the Aquaman movie, he kind of emerges out of the water, brandishing with his new look, brandishing that trident. And there's no question that the messaging is, this is the new face of the god Poseidon. There's no question about that's what that was the kind of rhetorical, you know, messaging that was there for the end of the movie.
Yeah, notice that in the movie he's all tatted up.
Yeah, yeah, that comes in. Of course, that all that stuff comes is a pagan concept, right? The painting,
the
marking of the flesh, which is forbidden in the Old Testament to Israel, because this is it always has tattoos and jewelry in the Old Testament all had religious worship significance. They weren't just trinkets to be for display.
And related to that is the self-mutilation as well. So people, even in our culture, there's cutting that goes on, and that all happened in some pagan circles.
Yep. It all has a religious significance. And as paganism comes into our culture, you notice those things are the things that are coming back in spades as being popular.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Dave, in addition to literally being the pagan gods, the Marvel and DC heroes seem to mimic certain traits of the pagan gods, even the ones that aren't, historical gods. So for instance, what are they mimicking here? So for instance, like the pagan deities, the movie heroes have more or less a regional jurisdiction. So Batman protects Gotham. The Daredevil protects Hell's Kitchen. And so they each have their city, which is, you know, again, a pagan concept.
Yeah, this is a great, great point, Dan. You should play yourself a great point, Uncle Dan, whatever clip we have there.
That was an awesome deconstruction.
I got to get set up so I can just play it for you. Yeah. But no, that's an excellent point to make, because that is a parallel that along with the way that their skills are, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's another point. Yeah, they have very specialized skills, much like the pagan gods.
Yeah.
Do any examples come to mind?
Well, you've got Aquaman that we just played. He's got control over water, right?
Exactly.
And then you got the kind of levels, like Superman is a high level entity. He's got all kinds of powers. And then you go down into the lesser, like the B class and C class superheroes, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. And Dave, I actually heard or read somewhere that early on Superman, you know, as he was being developed, he was actually too powerful and he became boring to people. So they actually had to limit his powers to some extent.
Yeah. They had to, he grew in his power set.
Yeah.
Initially he couldn't fly. He could just leap tall buildings, and then eventually he could fly, and his powers just became, the stories became boring for people. And so they had to give him some limitations, and kryptonite came in and other things like that. And his popularity came back. So it's kind of interesting. Now, Dan, you got me thinking, because I have a clip, and it's not in the clip list, so you'll have to go into the Dropbox and pull it out. But it's called Shazam Transfer of Powers. And this is interesting because it captures this essence of these specialized skills being pulled in from kind of local and other deities. So anyways, play it and we can talk about it.
Yeah, I'm just pulling it over here. For our listeners, while I do this, If you don't know, Dave and I are connected over the internet. We're actually physically over 500 kilometers apart in space. But, you know, in virtual space here over the internet, we're about, you know, half a second in delay away from each other. Yeah. But here it is. I finally got it. Here's a clip.
My magic must be passed on. Now, speak my name.
I don't know your name, sir. We just met.
My name is Shazam.
Wait, for real?
Say it!
Okay! Jeez. So just say it? Like, Shazam?
Yes! Carry my name, and with it you carry all my powers. The wisdom of Solomon, the strength of Hercules, the stamina of Atlas, the power of Zeus, the courage of Achilles, and the speed of Mercury.
What happened to me? Why am I... What did you do to me? What did you do to my voice?
You have been transformed to your full potential, Billy Batson. With your heart, unlock your greatest power. The thrones of our brothers and sisters await.
Yeah, so notice he's got the speed of Mercury and the, you know, I forget what they all are, the power of Zeus or the strength of Hercules, right?
Yeah.
And he's got the wisdom of Solomon. So none of the Greek gods seem to have any wisdom. So they've got to pull in from the biblical tradition for Solomon. but it's all
good
thrown
example.
In together, right? Because it's, yeah, it's all myth. It's all good. You know, just throw, slam it together and off we go. And a perfect rebranding. Of another one of these Greek kind of powers and myths into a thing that's packaged specifically for kids, right? Specifically
yeah.
for kids. This is a kid's superhero.
Yeah, and it's a really good example of these specialized skills that these gods or heroes have. And Dave, notice that he says, "Say my name." Is that what he said in there?
Yeah. That's right. Because he has to say his name in order to transfer the powers.
Yeah. So the idea that the name, there's something in saying the name that has power or that has some efficacy. And you think about all the names of the various deities that are being dropped all over the place in these movies and these books. And children could be saying the names and not even know what they're actually saying.
Yeah, that's right. And ultimately, as we were digging into this and you look at kind of review all this mythology, there's names that I had either forgotten or not known. And I realized, oh, wait, I came across that in, remember that came up in that book or that show or whatever. And you don't really realize how pervasive this cultural kind of infiltration is of these pagan ideas and concepts and entities and all this kind of stuff till you really kind of do a deep dive and start putting the pieces together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're talking about how these Marvel and DC heroes mimic some of the traits of the pagan gods. And we said, you know, they have regional jurisdiction, they have specialized skill. And another way they're similar is that they can get injured or even die, again, like some of the pagan gods. So even though they're formidable, they're not indestructible. And I think there's even a case where Superman dies, I believe, and then he's brought back to life.
Yeah, I don't remember, but the gods, the one point to make is that the Greek gods, any of the pagan gods, are not eternal in that sense, and we'll get into this maybe some other time. But they are, because they didn't think that was appropriate for the gods. They didn't like that idea.
Yeah, and they're so part of this universe in some sense.
That's right. They're part of the universe. They're part of the created order. And they're not the creator God who sits over everything, who creates everything.
And who's transcendent and above everything. Yeah, who's not
part
of the creation. Yes, indeed. That's a very key difference, between Christianity and the pagan gods. And of course, also, with regard to these DC heroes, you know, they have a multitude of heroes and even female heroes, just like there is this gaggle of pagan gods and female gods and goddesses, I guess. And I guess to the list, we can also add that the heroes sometimes use magical artifacts. And in paganism, you see people using artifacts often that have some magical powers that they use to affect some sort of change in the world and to do their will or something like that. So the Marvel and DC movie heroes seem to be just retraining young people to feel comfortable with or even to desire a sort of polytheism and a kind of a pagan ideology.
That's right. I would agree with that fully.
All right, Dave. So we dealt with polytheism. So now, aside from polytheism, some pagans also believe in what's known as pantheism, that God is the universe or that everything is part of God. And also, mm-hmm. some pagans believe in animism, which refers to the idea that objects have spirits or souls.
That's right. And when you look at the Wikipedia entry for paganism, it states this: most modern pagan religions existing today, modern or neo-paganism, express a worldview that is pantheistic, polytheistic, or animistic.
There it is.
And yeah, that's right. And so pantheistic, animistic, those are the two new concepts that we've just introduced. And animism is from the Latin anima, or breath or spirit or life. And according to Wikipedia, this is the religious belief that objects, places, and creatures all possess a distinct spiritual essence. So potentially animism perceives all things, animals, plants, rocks, rivers, weather systems, human handiwork, and perhaps even words as animated and alive.
Yeah, Dave. And you mentioned the word, the Latin word anima, and we have to be clear that we don't mean enema.
Yeah, no.
Though if you take the psychedelic enema, and I'm referring to an early episode of the show, yeah, you might certainly experience things as having animistic properties. But we'll get to that just in a second. Go on, Dave.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Referencing everybody back to an earlier episode that we did. But, you know, one more on paganism before we go there. The Oxford American Dictionary, that's the one on the Mac, has this for paganism: a modern religious movement incorporating beliefs or practices from outside the main world religions, especially nature worship. And that's a big part of what we would consider paganism as we think about it now, is this nature worship.
Yeah, nature worship and the notion of nature as being spiritual or having some spiritual component. And I think today we see various forms of the eco-movement taking on these neo-pagan ideas about, you know, the sacredness of the earth, and even that the earth is more important than people. All this maniacal madness, mm-hmm. get rid of the people, save the earth!
Yeah, you know, one of our listeners, Peter, from we read an email from him a while back, sent us some links to recent articles. One was the title, "The Earth Needs Fewer People to Beat the Climate Crisis, Scientists Say." Right?
Yeah.
So, and the other one was, "Critics Blast the Proposal to Curb Climate Change by Halting Population Growth." And I just read the first paragraph there. And more than 11,000 scientists from a broad range of disciplines signed a new editorial declaring a climate emergency. But other researchers immediately criticized one of the proposed remedies, halting population growth. So this is, you know, this is kind of this you know, anti-humankind, this misanthropic approach because of this sacredness of the earth stuff is a little bit disturbing.
Yeah, and we should certainly cover that later on, these kinds of Malthusian ideas or Malthusian type ideas, and you know, why they're coming back into our culture.
Yeah, I've got a clip here from this is another late edition, so you have to fish it out, but this is from a Final Fantasy, The Spirit Within or something like that, I think it was. It's this huge franchise of, I think it's a gaming franchise, and it's got some animated movies, and I'm not going to get into the background because it's just complicates things. But notice as you listen to this first clip, notice how it promotes and normalizes the scientific endorsement of this Gaia theology. So Dan, if you could play that Final Fantasy Gaia theology clip, that would be
Gaia
good.
Theology. Okay, here it is.
Two more pieces and we've solved the puzzle.
And we need to be free to find those pieces. I want to show you something, Aki.
What is this?
Read.
All life is born of Gaia, and each life has a spirit. Each new spirit is housed in a physical body.
Doctor.
Go on.
Through their experiences on Earth, each spirit matures and grows. When the physical body dies, the mature spirit, enriched by its life on Earth, returns to Gaia, bringing with it the experiences, enabling Gaia to live and grow.
It's my old diary. I wrote that 43 years ago when I was the age you are now.
Dr. Sid.
Remember what happened to Galileo? They threw him in jail because he said the Earth was not the center of the universe. That could happen to us. Our ideas are unpopular, Aki. If you have any notes or records that could be used against you, destroy them. Keep them up here.
Right.
Oh, this—it's framed like David fighting Goliath. Like we've got this. We've got
that's
this
right.
knowledge.
Well, Galileo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Galileo, and of course Galileo was ultimately proven right. And so the idea is, well, our Gaia theology here is going to be proven right in the end. And so we got to do what we got to do. Even these 11,000 scientists, you know, they're right in working on population reduction, whatever it be, right? However you want to cull the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And it's legitimized in these kinds of shows. I got one more clip from this thing here, and it's about a minute 50 seconds. It's a little longer, and yep. it shows this whole idea of spirits in everything. So it's probably worth listening to. So go ahead and play that one.
So will you tell me about them?
About what?
About the spirits you've collected.
I was infected by a phantom during an experiment. Normally, no one could have survived.
How did you?
Dr. Sid created a membrane around the infection, keeping me alive. So the first spirit wave was me. The second was a fish.
A fish?
The third was a deer I found in a wildlife preserve outside Moscow. The fourth was a bird. Ever tried to track a sparrow from outer space? It's no fun. What am I saying? You probably would love that.
You're right, I probably would.
And then there was that plant I collected from Times Square.
I thought that was number six.
What?
You skipped one.
The fifth was a little girl dying in a hospital emergency room. I retrieved the sample in time, but she... I told her everything had a spirit. Dogs, cats, trees, little girls.
Trees?
Even the earth. I told her that she wasn't dying, just returning to the earth spirit, to Gaia. She told me that she was ready to die. She said I didn't have to make up stories to make her feel better. Only 7 years old and ready to die.
I'm sorry.
I have work to do. I have to find the seventh and eighth spirits. Don't, please. You don't believe any of this, do you?
I just don't know, Aki.
Yeah, and at the end, I finally believe. There's this, you know, it's not worth explaining how the whole thing unpacks, but there's this conversion element there in that character there. And at one point they see the spirit of Gaia and they got to make sure they don't injure the spirit of Gaia and all this kind of stuff. But notice the reason I had it in here was notice the spirits are people, but also animals and plants.
Yeah, trees.
And trees, right? And all this kind of stuff. So
yeah, that's animism. It's clearly animism.
Yeah, that's what we were talking about, was animism, and it's being, again, it's being propagated, it's being brought into the common parlance and the consciousness of the younger generation.
Well, Dave, at this point, I think we have to talk a little bit about the psychedelics, which we covered in an earlier episode of the show. And I want to talk about that because some psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, give people the experience that nature has a spirit or that natural objects have spirits. And I think it's conceivable that the modern movement towards paganism that takes the form of nature worship might be driven at least partly by the psychedelics or psychedelic use. And maybe we can call the people inspired towards paganism in this way the psychedelic pagans.
There you go. Yeah. So a new term coined here on the Not Conform Show, psychedelic pagans.
The psychedelic pagans. You got to listen to the Not Conform Show.
Yeah. This is the Not Conform Show.
Conform Show. Make sure you tell everyone you know.
Yeah, as a current example of someone who has taken psychedelics and as a result moved closer towards and animistic perspectives, and perhaps he's not fully there yet, but we can point to the well-known author Michael Pollan, who has recently written a book on psychedelics, which we covered in a previous episode of the show. And here's some background. This is Michael Pollan speaking in this clip.
We think we've got it all figured out. And you need to shake that confidence. You need to inject some noise in the system. I write as a curious person. I was kind of a newbie to the psychedelic community, so I think that made it much more accessible to other people. I was a very reluctant psychonaut. I had 6 guided journeys, 2 ayahuasca circles, 1 LSD, 1 psilocybin, 1 5-MeO-DMT. The night before, every one of these experiences was sleepless. The cautionary voice was my ego trying to protect itself against an assault. It's a kind of death, and you fight it. If you've been properly prepared, you're going to surrender to it.
So you take the psychedelic, and then you surrender to the death of your ego, of yourself, and have a very special experience. And I'm using air quotes around special experience. And Pollan believes that the psychedelics are going to change the world.
Something's going on. The culture is ready to have this conversation. I do see these medicines as addressing some of the big problems we face as a society. The environmental crisis, which flows from our disconnection from nature, and tribalism, which flows from our disconnection from people unlike ourselves.
So notice that he says the psychedelics are going to solve the environmental problems, and they're also going to bring everyone together. And he goes on to describe his experience of plants and nature under the influence of psilocybin. Listen to this.
But man, I felt it for the first time, that these plants in my garden were regarding me in some sense. They don't have eyes or anything, but they were just like their presence, the sense that they did have, that I wasn't the only subject. You know, normally we think we're the only subject, everything else is an object. No, they were subjects too. There were spirits in that sense everywhere. And it's a very common phenomenon on psychedelics to have this sense that consciousness is more evenly spread over the world and not just locked in here, and that other beings are more alive than you realized. And I definitely had that with these plants. And I felt like I was one character among many in this garden rather than the human overseeing the garden. And it was a deeper connection to nature than I'd ever felt.
Yeah, so he says the plants had spirits and he had a deep connection with the plants, Dave.
Yeah, that's right. And notice how he says that he felt that he was not the human overseeing the garden, but just one of the characters in the garden, mm-hmm. right? And this is a direct pot shot, I think, at Christianity, where mankind is placed in the Garden of Eden, in order to be the gardener, to be the caretaker, to be the overseer, to use Michael Pollan's term.
Yeah.
And he's trying to turn that worldview upside down.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember he wrote an article for The Atlantic where he describes this exact thing, the psilocybin experience, and I got a quote here. He's looking at a plant and he writes, "The leaves were also looking back at me, fixing me with this utterly benign gaze. I could feel their curiosity and what I was certain was an attitude of utter benevolence toward me and my kind." And then he adds, "I looked through the negative spaces formed by the hydrangea leaves to fix my gaze on the swamp maple in the middle of the meadow beyond, and it too was now more alive than I'd ever known a tree to be, infused with some kind of spirit, this one too benevolent." And, yeah. You know, he talks about the fear that he had every night before he would do this. Well, he should have said, this is because of his materialistic worldview, because he should have been afraid of the entities that he was going to be encountering.
Exactly.
And not been so open to submitting to whatever was going to come in his direction.
Yeah. And he very clearly says that the tree was infused with some kind of spirit. He very mm-hmm. clearly identifies it as having a spirit. Now, listen to this clip.
It was a deeper connection to nature than I'd ever felt. I don't think there's anything supernatural about that. I would say it's spiritual in this sense.
So he said he had a very deep connection with nature, but he doesn't call it supernatural. And that's because he wants to still be a materialist. He says, nevertheless, that it was spiritual. So what does this mean? He unpacks it further in this clip.
I assume that spiritual meant supernatural in some sense, that you had to leave the laws of nature and science. And it was an experience that refuted them by showing you that there was some divine force you weren't aware of, or God, or whatever it was. And I didn't buy that. But I came to understand spirituality in a different way over the course of writing this book. And that was that the opposite of spiritual is not material, as I had thought. The opposite of spiritual is egotistical. And that it is ego and the ego defenses that wall us off from the kinds of really powerful connections that constitute a spiritual experience.
And let's finish up with this one.
So when I came to understand that was the opposite, that I was having spiritual experiences, and they were experiences of deep, powerful connection. And that's what I think spirituality is. Now, for some people, that connection is with some idea of the divinity and higher power. And I can totally even see that in a naturalistic sense. So I don't think I've given up my materialism, but I have acquired a spirituality without it, without giving it up. And that was a big surprise for me and a big turn.
So he hasn't given up materialism, the view that all there exists is matter, but he has become spiritual, imbibing nature with a certain spiritual character or the feeling of some sort of spirituality in nature. And I think this is very close to an animistic view, perhaps not precisely animistic, but it's very, very close. And it's completely consistent with a modern paganism or neo-pagan views. And
that's right. I think Paulin hasn't fully worked out the implications of his shifting worldview yet, because, he bought into the false dichotomy of material versus spiritual as if spiritual had to be supernatural. And here he's talking about he's got Christianity and God, the Christian God, in his crosshairs when he says that. Mm-hmm. But what he's trying to say is, well, I'm a materialist. I still think it's not supernatural, but now my nature, my material nature, involves this spirit in everything,
right? Yes.
Which he thinks is different. So it's therefore not supernatural. It's different than the God of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he hasn't worked this out yet. He's very much animist. I would say he's animist in his worldview.
Yeah.
He just doesn't really understand it yet.
Yeah, we could see how the psychedelic drugs, which were used by people since time immemorial all over the world, can be, when being used right now, can be leading people to animism and to neo-paganism. Mm-hmm. And I guess, Dave, the question is Paulin a psychedelic pagan? What do you think?
Yeah, Dan, I think when they put psychedelic pagan in the dictionary, they're going to have a picture of Michael Paulin beside it.
Indeed, I hope they do. And I hope they credit the show for making up the term.
That's right.
Well, I have another example here, Dave. Listeners of earlier episodes of the podcast will recall author Graham Hancock's experience after taking the psychedelic ayahuasca. Listen to this.
Another universal experience of ayahuasca is the encounter with seemingly intelligent entities which communicate with us telepathically. Now, I'm making no claim one way or another as to the reality status of these entities we encounter. Simply that phenomenologically, in the ayahuasca experience, they are encountered by people all over the world. And most frequently of all, the spirit of ayahuasca herself, Mother Ayahuasca, who is a healer. And although she's kind of the mother goddess of the planet, she seems to take a direct personal interest in us as individuals, to heal our ills, to want us to be the best that we can possibly be, to correct errors and mistakes in our behavior that may be leading us down the wrong path.
Yeah. Oh yeah, Mother Goddess Ayahuasca. Here we have a full-blown goddess, one of the many entities encountered with ayahuasca. And of course, this is beyond animism. It's right to goddess worship. And then if you think about all the other things as being some sort of deities that they experience, it's almost like polytheistic mm-hmm. worship. So the psychedelic, yeah. they're not only restricted to bringing people to animism, they might also just bring people to polytheism even.
That's right. And just going back to animism, remember, I think it was either Paul and we had a clip of, or it was Hancock who talks about when the researchers were asking, well, how did you come up with this concoction of ayahuasca? Because it's not intuitive how they got it. The answer was the plants told them to do this.
So, yeah.
So again, you know, this psychedelic animism, right?
Yeah. And Dave, this is actually coming into the scientific domain now. I should mention one of the leading philosophers of consciousness, a guy named David Chalmers, has recently mm-hmm. become a proponent of the idea of panpsychism, which is a notion that all matter has consciousness as a fundamental property. So everything is conscious. Mm-hmm. Listen to him talking about this.
I mean, if you're a panpsychist, you say there is consciousness at the fundamental level of the natural order. I mean, this changes the physical worldview from one that just involves dead matter to one that involves mind at the fundamental level. So metaphysically, I think it's radical, and many physicalists, I think, are going to find it too radical a view for their tastes. But if you ask me just philosophically, I think it actually can preserve much of what is attractive about physicalism while still making room for irreducible consciousness.
Yeah, so the idea is that everything is conscious, Dave. Your microphone has consciousness. So be careful what you say into your microphone.
Hey, this puts a whole new spin on passing blame. Now you don't have to just blame people. You can blame stuff.
Yeah.
I like this. This is good.
Yeah. And you notice that he says it adds something to materialism, right? Because it uh-huh. also it essentially gives life to something that's otherwise dead. And to me, that's getting very close to this idea of animism.
Well, it's because materialism is ultimately unsatisfying. And so they got to try to bolster with something.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that they're drifting into that. You know, I think what I got to remind my vegetarian friends is that, hey, you're eating dead plants.
That's right. And they had consciousness too. They had consciousness too.
Yeah.
Well, here's a clip from a TED talk given by Chalmers in which he's talking about panpsychism.
It's also worth noting that although the idea seems counterintuitive to us, it's much less counterintuitive to people from different cultures where the human mind is seen as much more continuous with nature.
Yes, it's completely consistent with the pagan worldview. He's bringing paganism into science. He's making humans less unique and blending them with nature, making them much more continuous with the rest of the world. I think he's spouting animism.
Yep.
Yep. You're not going to challenge me on that. That's good.
I'm not going to challenge you on that. I agree.
That's good.
So, Dan, let's get into the topic of pagan worship. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the main forms of worship among pagans. And maybe we'll go back to the Romans here because there's some concrete historical material here. And let's focus on the worship of the civic gods, the city gods in the Roman pantheon.
Okay. Well, according to Robin Fox, it's best to think about Roman paganism in terms of a collection of cults. And Fox writes, quote, "The central cult acts for the civic gods occurred on the days of their festivals. The people processed, sang hymns, and sacrificed in the gods' honor," end quote. So evidently, they would have these festivals, and during these festivals, the Romans would bring statues of their gods on processions. They would sacrifice animals to their gods and celebrate with a lot of music and revelry.
Yeah, so it's important to remember that the Romans didn't really have holidays, right? They didn't have like Labor Day weekend and Family Day mm-hmm. weekend and Victoria Day weekend. And so these festivals took the place of that. That was their holidays, and it was something that people really looked forward to.
Yes, and according to Fox, quote, "It also brought on the horse. not just the sacred prostitutes of a few remaining cults, end quote. So the whores were possibly slaves who were dragged to the festivals by their masters. And as it turns out, sex was a key part of paganism. And Steve Smith also points out that, quote, the gods manifested themselves as well and were honored through sexuality. Sexual ecstasy being understood as the mysterious indwelling presence of the gods. And at the end there, he quotes from the historian Kyle Harper. And we're going to spend more time on the issue of pagan views of sexuality in the next episode, hopefully. But that was certainly a part of the revelry that we were just talking about. So lots of celebration and a lot of inappropriate sexual activity.
That's right. And there's a reason why the degradation of morality in the West and the openness to alternative lifestyles, let's say we'll call them, and the infiltration of paganism all go hand in hand with what we're seeing happen in the culture wars. And so we'll get into that a little bit more next episode.
Yeah, because people think that, you know, the current sexual trends occurred because of the sex revolution in the 60s. No, it occurred because of historical practices that have been bubbling under the surface and are just now re-emerging. And that's why it's so important for us to deal with this topic of paganism. But Dave, Fox makes this very important point. He says the following, quote, by modern historians, pagan religion has been defined as essentially a matter of cult acts. He says, pagans performed rites, but professed no creed or doctrine, end quote. So it was about specific acts, about performing specific rites.
Yeah, that's a very important point to make. And Dan, I was listening to a lecture by Dr. Ryan Reeves, who is an assistant professor of historical theology at Gordon Cromwell, and he had the theological seminary, and he's got this YouTube channel, which has got a lot of great historical, well-produced stuff. And this is from a lecture, Roman Pagan Life and Worship. And I grabbed a couple of clips where he makes this point, and it's worth paying attention to, because in Western Christianity, we think in terms of doctrine, a set of propositions to be believed and adhered to, whereas in the pagan world, the mindset is a bit different, right? The focus is on ritual. So if you could play my first clip, and then maybe we'll go into the second one as well.
And so in this lecture, we're going to take time to look at Roman pagan life and worship itself. We're going to ask the question, what was it like to worship as a pagan? What would it have been like to participate in the day-to-day rituals, in the day-to-day establishment of the Roman world? And we are asking these questions not simply for the sake of understanding the historical past, of simply understanding the Greco-Roman world, but the way that the Romans engaged in their religion, not in their faith. Romans are very keen on this. They do not have faith. They have a cultic worship. They have a sacrificial system that pays tribute to the gods and therefore gains benefit to them.
Yeah, and here's your second clip.
And so from the beginning, your home, your family, all that makes you you, at least in terms of the physical DNA of who you are, and in terms of the home where you live, is associated with a veneration of the past, of the antiquity of your elders, as well as doing oblation and performing certain sacrifices to lesser deities on behalf of your family. Now, it needs to be stressed at this point that this was not a personal faith. Again, the Romans do not like the word faith. For them, there is no sense of faith in their cultic worship. Rather, there is obligation. There is a duty. There are sacrifices that need to be made. One could very well not care much at all. You don't have to have your heart in it. You don't have to be faithful. You don't have to be full of faith in order to perform these obligations. But these obligations have to be performed. They need to be done in just the right way. If the shrine you have set up in your home calls for a certain oblation of, say, wine or wheat, well, you can't switch it up. You can't decide one day, well, I'm out of wine. I know I'll put something else down. That'll do. Rather, you have to perform the rituals as they are prescribed. And they are prescribed in the foggy past. They're not things that you inquire about. Why did we start offering this? Your job as an average man or woman is simply to perform them, to not mess them up, to do your obligation on behalf of your family.
So it's not about faith, it's about performing actions.
Yeah, performing notice he uses the word specifically obligations, right? Mm-hmm. Performing obligations, and you got to get them right.
Yes.
You can't mess it up.
Otherwise, things go awry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dave, I think this point about paganism being primarily about acts and rites rather than a creed or a doctrine is key because it helps us understand how paganism is making its way into Western culture under various seemingly innocuous cloaks. And I think a good example of this would be the practice of yoga. You know, some of the various movements and we could say pretzeled postures known to yoga practitioners are postures of ritual veneration of Indian deities. And, you know, Christians might be doing yoga and thinking they're just exercising, but in fact, they're engaging in cult acts and religious rituals.
That's right.
Dave, have you ever heard of super brain yoga?
Super brain yoga. No, yeah. I'm searching my brain, but nothing comes up.
Well, I read about it in a research article published in a relatively respected journal called Psychology of Consciousness, Theory, Research, and Practice. And the article was authored by Jeremy Genovese and Kathleen Little from Cleveland State University. And in the article, they describe two empirical tests of the effectiveness of a type of yoga that goes by this name, super brain yoga. And apparently, it was popularized by the founder of the pranic healing movement, Master Chao Kok Sui, and is, at least it was at the time the article was written, practiced daily at a junior public school in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. And the school is called Lingate Junior Public School. And so people could go on their website. I don't know if it's there today, but it was when this article was written. In this research paper, Genovese and Little quote a document that was published by Lingate describing the practice. Okay. And so also, by the way, this was supported by the Toronto District School Board. Okay, here's mm-hmm. the quote, super brain yoga is an effective technique designed to specifically optimize brain wellness to improve mental performance and regulate emotions by energizing the brain to stimulate the production of alpha brain waves, which produce a synchronization of the right and left hemispheres of the brain, creating the brain's most optimal state for a healthy, conscious learning. End quote.
Wow, that sounds great.
Yeah. That sounds really great.
So that's a pretty mind-boggling idea. Like, seriously, that's a mind-boggling idea.
Okay, so what do you do when you perform super brain yoga? Okay, super brain yoga involves crossing your hands and grasping your ears with the thumb and forefinger of the opposite hand while doing squats. All right? So that's all it involves.
This sounds like one of those, this says pat your tummy in your head, you know, do the circles.
Yeah, it's something like that, yeah. And Genovese and Little conducted two rigorous experiments on the effectiveness of super brain yoga. And they were using well-accepted measures of performance and cognitive ability. And they found that super brain yoga had no effect on performance, on cognitive performance, relative to a control group that just involves squatting. And that's the control group they chose.
There you go.
And it had no effect, right? So this is just, it's bunk. It doesn't actually do anything. But here's the kicker, Dave. Super mm-hmm. brain yoga resembles, and now I'm quoting, a practice called Thapukuranam, a form of penance to the Hindu god Ganesha. Okay, which means that even though it has no effect on your cognitive performance, it may yet have some effects that were simply beyond the scope of the experimental study. And I'm thinking of some spiritual effects.
Spiritual effects. That's right. Because in the pagan perspective, you can't separate the belief and the enactment of the ritual. In fact, the belief is like, who cares?
Yes.
Right? Just do the ritual, and that enactment of that ritual constitutes the worship or the fulfillment of the obligation.
Exactly. If you're out there and you're listening to my voice and your kids are involved in this stuff at their school, I want to say this. It's not an effective technique to improve your cognitive performance. It doesn't create the brain's most optimal state. I'm talking about super brain yoga. No matter what Master Sui or your non-discerning public school teacher say, it's a form of Hindu god worship, And as you say, Dave, from the pagan worldview, it's the enactment that matters.
That's right. And you know, there's an interesting debate going on in actually North American yoga circles, and that's the true practitioners would say, look, you all you know yoga mat carrying the masses that practice yoga, you're doing it wrong because you're trying to make it into an exercise, a popular exercise, whereas yoga actually is spiritual. Just by doing it, you're on the first rung of Buddhism, just by actually posing in these postures.
Yeah. So when you're doing downward facing dog, Dave, what you're getting is into a posture that the Kundalini snake can climb into you and up your spine and then occupy your physical body.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you want to stretch, go do some stretching. And it's actually been shown, exercise physiologists will say, look, some of these postures aren't even good for you. They overstretch your joints, and they have all these, you know, they're bad for your back. They have all these negative effects that they're not even good exercises if you really dig into them a lot.
Yeah, Dave, we have to do a show on specifically this, on the practice of yoga. But you're reminding me, I have a colleague whose wife was an avid yoga practitioner. In fact, she was an instructor deep into it for a very long time. And recently she became a Christian. And she said that when she finally put her faith in Christ, what happened was there were essentially demons living inside her, and they rushed out of her. When the name of Jesus when she was praying in the name of Jesus, and we got to get her on the show as a third mic at some point, to interview her.
That sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But these things are very powerful spiritual practices, and people who are deep into it have had these sorts of scary demonic experiences.
Because the physical enactment is what matters.
Indeed. So, Dave, let's say a bit about the massive pagan temples that the pagans worshipped in. Some of the larger cults had these dedicated temples, sometimes very extravagant temples, for their gods and their goddesses.
Yeah, so you'd have your religious life, you'd have your home altar with your household gods, and then you'd have the main temple of the city that would have the city's god. And this is where the elites would lead the population in the enactment of whatever the ritual required, the sacrifices and all that kind of stuff.
A good example is the massive temple devoted to the goddess Artemis in the city of Ephesus, which would have been one of the commercial hubs in Asia Minor. Our Christian audience might recognize Ephesus from the book of Ephesians, but also it was mentioned in Acts.
The book of Acts.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Dave, do you remember the mention of that?
Yeah. I mean, this is where the Paul's preaching leads to, a falling away and a lessening of the worship of the Ephesian goddess Aphrodite, right? Or Artemis.
Artemis, yeah.
Yeah, Artemis, and so they get mad because it's the silversmith gets mad because it's taking away from their trade, right?
Yeah. So, now, Dave, you gave me a very interesting book by Clinton Arnold. It's called Power and Magic: The Concept of Power in Ephesians, I gave it back to you last time you were here. But according to the book, Artemis was believed to have supernatural power, and she had control over nature and other lower gods and spirits. In fact, she was referred to as the queen of the cosmos.
That's right. Here's a quote from that book here. Arnold writes, Artemis plays an important role in Greco-Roman times as a goddess of the underworld. This role is particularly evident in the magical papyri. She possesses authority and control over the multiplicity of demons of the dead and also the demons of nature. She is virtually identified with Hecate, Selene, and the Babylonian goddess Ereshkigal, who are even more widely renowned as goddesses of the underworld.
So they're thonic goddesses. There's the word thonic
entities. Yeah,
that's right.
That's right. And then just a little bit later, Arnold writes this. He says, these goddesses are attributed with possessing the keys to the fort of Hades and therefore authority over the underworld gods and demons.
Yeah, so very much associated this Artemis with the underworld and with demons. And Dave, I understand that statues of Artemis sometimes have her chest covered with many breasts.
Yeah, like it's like row upon row of like three or four rows of side to side breasts.
Yeah, which could be part of her role as a fertility goddess. It seems that Artemis had three primary roles. Okay, she was the mother goddess, a fertility goddess, and the nature goddess. But also, there were these other roles that you just mentioned about being some sort of an underworld goddess. I mean, she was very prolific. She had lots of different roles and jurisdictions. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Dave, apparently there was a sexual component to the worship of Artemis.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember Clinton Arnold wrote about this.
Yeah, just like here. Oh, here he writes, the worship of Artemis is also thought to have been orgiastic in nature.
Woo!
With sacred prostitution as part of the ceremony. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this goes back actually to the fertility cults of the that goes all the way back to the Old Testament, right? Which the people were forbidden from, and yeah. Temple prostitution was a big thing there. Yeah,
yeah, and I remember Arnold also writing that the temple to Artemis functioned like a bank, and the temple or the organization owned and managed properties that provided with considerable financial wealth, and people as they traveled by would deposit their money in the temple. And so the temples too, they played this very key financial role.
That's right. And these festivals, what would happen is the god that the festival was to would essentially be showering the people with wealth. And so there'd be money handed out, maybe a special coin struck for the occasion and money kind of thrown about. And so if you were one of the masses who didn't have, not an elite who had wealth, but just one of the masses, this was one way of acquiring monetary, you know, some wealth just by showing up to the festival and trying to get a piece of this kind of action.
So people were motivated to go.
No, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Not just from the kind of the bacchanalia perspective, but even from just an economic perspective and a cultural perspective, all kinds of, this was a very central to the life of pagan Rome.
Dave, when I go to church, I don't get showered with money.
Yeah,
we've been doing this all wrong.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, Dan, I got a couple of clips here to illustrate this whole thing nicely, this temple thing. And, mm-hmm. and this is now notice this is from a cartoon, a kid's cartoon on Netflix called Grand Blue Fantasy. And notice how the narrative and this dialogue for this show is designed to teach young audiences, because this is for young audiences, the concepts of paganism.
That building is huge.
What's it for?
Are you interested in the temple?
Mm-hmm.
I gather this island's not your home.
What's a temple?
Well, more often recently, it's been used as an area for meetings and a place of business for merchants.
What's the statue for?
To honor Tiamat, the guardian goddess of Port Breeze. The gentle, pleasant breeze we enjoy on the island is all because of Tiamat. Many came here to offer prayers of thanks. But now that we can predict weather, there are far fewer that come to visit.
That's very sad.
If you have time, go in and pray to her. I'm sure that would please Tiamat.
Yes!
Wow, Dave, that's just so shocking. They mentioned Tiamat, and so maybe a lot of our listeners wouldn't know this unless you really dug into it. But Tiamat, historically, she's known as the goddess of chaos. She's a Mesopotamian goddess, sometimes I think depicted as a dragon.
Yeah, that's right. Not in this show as a dragon, but although actually she has dragon tail on this one. So
yeah.
So it's true. And notice what happens is it's kind of this wonderment. This these kids are wondering, what's that? And then they get educated about, oh, this is a temple. This is what you do here. This is how you do it. And that'll become even more evident in the clips that come up, the next clip especially.
So they're training the young people how to properly conduct themselves around temples and how to engage in temple worship.
That's right. And what happens in the show is There's a catastrophe because people are neglecting the worship of the goddess. And the second clip, I believe, it kind of picks up after that.
I'm sorry, goddess. After all of the sweet breezes you gave us, this happened because we forgot that you deserved our gratitude. I'll do everything I can to remind the citizens that without you, our island would perish. I apologize for all of us.
That is so shocking, man.
Yep. So there, he's praying, and the deity here, this goddess, is manifested in this large shimmering, in actually not just the statue he's talking to, but this large giant shimmering image of the goddess after the conflict has been resolved. And then just a little bit later, we get this next little dialogue here in the last clip.
Thank the gods that's over. What a wild ride.
I would like to say thank you, Rackham.
Huh?
For saving Tiamat and everyone on the island.
Huh? Actually, that's what I'm supposed to say. See that? So, Lyria, Tiamat is really back to normal, right?
Yes! The goddess has been released from the evil power that held her, so she'll favor Angana with a gentle breeze again.
You heard her.
Thank goodness! What a relief!
Hey, hold it down. There's more to say. We bear a lot of responsibility for what happened here. We messed up. We forgot the wind goddess. We can't do that. So whatever we have to do or think, we gotta make sure it never happens again. This island needs the goddess, and she needs to know we're grateful.
Yeah, Dave, I noticed in your clip that the people were encouraged to worship the goddess and to continue to venerate the goddess in order to avert calamity. And
that's right. That's right.
The idea was that if you neglect the goddess, there'll be some sort of a disaster. So you cannot neglect the goddess, and you have to make her feel wanted. Wow.
That's right. And that might be a nice way to segue it into the next principle we want to talk about, is utility.
That's right.
But just before we go there, notice that it starts with thank the gods. And it's funny because I've heard that actually, I've heard people say, I was listening to some podcasts and I've heard people say, instead of, you know, thank God, they'll say, well, we can thank the gods. So this is now coming into popular parlance that you'll see outside of these shows. And so here's your primer on paganism right there in this show for your 6-year-old, 8-year-old, 10-year-old or whatever, right? All there on Netflix, introducing also the names of these ancient deities and how you pray to them, how you interact with them, where you do that. All that stuff is right there, right?
So, Dave,
it's kind of shocking.
If we're subscribing to Netflix, we're paying for this stuff.
That's right. I'm just drinking.
I got you all choked up.
I was taking a sip as you said that. So. Well, no, I'm seriously thinking about unsubscribing, although it's still a good source of clips. But realistically, I mean, really, it's one of these things where you know, if we talk about pagan sexuality next episode, there's this thing from Netflix where they purport to give your children sex ed better than what they're getting at school through their shows. And we can talk about that a little bit later. But yeah, this is not a good thing to support. I agree.
Yeah. So we want to talk about how the pagans viewed their god in terms of the god's utility, their usefulness. And the pagans thought that they had to appease the gods in order for things to go well for them. And, you know, in this regard, the more gods, the better, because the more gods you appease, perhaps the better things would go. Fox, our historian, writes the following, quote, "From Britain to Syria, pagan cults aim to honor the gods and avert the misfortunes which might result from the gods' own anger and their neglect." And later on, it says, "Any account of pagan worship which minimizes the gods' uncertain anger and mortals' fear of it is an empty account," end quote. So, yeah, they were afraid that if they didn't appease the gods, things would go badly for them. This is this idea that the gods are of some particular use, and that's why you engage with them, not because you love them or because they love you or nothing like that. It's for pure utility, pure usefulness of the gods.
That's right. And you don't have to really be into it. That was, you don't have to, there's no faith required. That was one of the points that Ryan Reeves made in that clip I had. And I have another clip from that same lecture where he's talking about the regular offerings to the gods made at the family altar. And note the transactional utility of the god worshiper interaction that he nicely highlights in this little clip.
Your job as an average man or woman is simply to perform them, to not mess them up, to do your obligation on behalf of your family. And what is gained from doing this is not well-being or a sense of calm or peace in your own psyche. For the average man or woman in pagan Rome, the concern is that by performing these rituals, by performing these sacrifices and venerating the name of your ancestors, that you will get benefit. Again, not personal benefit, not psychological benefit. Material benefit is what's in mind here. You will be fertile. You will have lots of children. You will have success in your businesses. You will have success if you are in the military, in battle. And so what is done here is an obligation to the ancestors so that your family, so that your personal lineage can carry on after you have gone your way as well, that those that come after you will continue the sacrifices and the obligations to the deities and will venerate your name now that you have passed on. And so it is very much wrapped up with the maintenance of the family, maintaining your ancestry, therefore maintaining your own name as it carries on through your children and your children's children, etc.
It's kind of grim, Dave, and in some sense narcissistic, because all you care about is your name being carried on somehow, as if that ought to matter.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a certain bondage to the system here that, when the Apostle Paul talks about you've been freed from this, this is something that was done, that the Christian understanding of the world just does away with this whole kind of transactional interaction.
Indeed.
Now, I got a couple of clips that really from that same show, The Grand Blue Fantasy, that illustrate, once again, that are designed to teach kids the principle of utility, right? To show them how this whole kind of transactional thing works.
Well, the people of Aguste are not pushovers. Eventually, we'll succeed in driving the Empire out. And then the people of Aguste will be restored. Our guardian deity, Leviathan, is with us.
Your guardian?
Leviathan?
Yeah, not only that, he's a great and generous deity to boot. You guys should pray to the sea as well. It would probably pay off.
What kind of payoff are you thinking?
For starters, Leviathan would give you good fortune. Works with everything. Warding off evil, good luck, bountiful harvest, sound health, matchmaking, also safe and fair journeys.
Sounds too good to be true.
Does it even work outside of Fanta Grande Skydome?
I wonder.
Another one of these prolific deities.
That's right. Well, I should have set this one up a little bit. So they're the whole thing behind here is they travel, they're on this quest, and they're traveling from island to island in this archipelago in this kind of it's like an old ship with a technological, like a balloon blimp attached to it and some propellers and stuff. So it's this mixture of, steampunk kind of old and technology. And they're in a new island, and now they're learning about that local deity, which in this case is Leviathan, right? And his benefits. And like you said, it's all good for everything, right?
Yeah. And
by the way, you should pray to the sea too while you're at it, just to cover your bases, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it seems like, again, we have these territorial jurisdictions of these gods. And Dave, Leviathan typically is construed, I think, in Revelation as being some beast of the sea that wasn't very good, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to keep these things from eating you, right? it's a sea monster essentially, right? So yeah. you got to keep them happy and make sure that you don't get giant tidal waves coming to get you. I got another clip. I got another clip that illustrates this in terms of charms and things and then trinkets, which we already alluded to earlier. So go ahead and roll that one.
Excuse me, what are these?
Good afternoon, miss. This is all stuff that's made of coral and shells from the island. They say if you wear a bunch of treasures from the sea, the guardian deity will extend lots of blessings to you.
Extend blessings? Oh, like good health or safe travels, huh?
Exactly. The red ones are for health, and the green ones are for good journeys. The blessing you get depends on the color.
What does this yellow one do?
Luck with money.
Oh, and the pink one?
Easy childbirth.
Oh, how beautiful!
What's all this?
These are things they say will bring good luck.
Huh.
This particular shade of blue is a very special color to us islanders. The color represents our deep connection to the ocean.
A deep connection?
We live with the sea, and the sea gives us life. And this deep blue symbolizes that inseparable connection. So we use it as a charm that helps us to build deeper relationships and stronger bonds with all the people around us.
Wonderful! That's lovely!
Excuse me?
Wonderful!
I'll take this.
Yikes, man.
That's lovely!
Yeah. Yeah, and you have these trinkets, right? They're basically, they have artifacts that are special and they confer some, maybe some special powers.
That's right. And you get normalized into this way of thinking. And then pretty soon you're going out to the mall and getting some special power crystals and whatever new age trinkets are out there. Right. There's good business in this.
Yeah. Right? And this show is aimed at little kids and they're talking about a crystal or whatever that trinket was that was going to make birth easier. Like, why would the 6-year-olds be interested in that?
Well, they need to understand all the concepts, right?
Yeah.
So it's designed to tell them. And what's very interesting is it just occurred to me that this word, the guardian deity, well, that's kind of awkward, right? That's not the way we would say it. But I think it's a way to get around this idea of a god, right? That the first commandment is still a little bit too entrenched in Western consciousness, you know, you shall have no other gods. So let's just say guardian deity and we'll it won't trigger that alarm, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Interesting.
Yeah, very subtle. Yeah. You know, when I was one of the things I read, Dave, was that this idea of having multiple gods was actually very useful for the authorities because it helped them essentially control the population in a way, because what they would just say is whenever a calamity occurred or any kind of misfortune, they would just say that the misfortune occurred because the people neglected one of the gods. And because there are so many gods, it's certainly the case that you're neglecting at least one of them at some point. And so it's an easy way for the governing authorities to basically deflect any criticism and put the onus back on the people in terms of that they weren't, you know, worshiping the gods properly and appeasing the proper gods, and they were neglecting some gods. So very useful for the authorities.
Yeah. Again, the principle of utility.
It's just in a different way. That's right.
That's right. It's not us mismanaging the public trust. No, no, no. You just forgot to pray to those gods over there.
Yeah. So Dave, as we come to the end of this episode, let's discuss one more thing. I want to talk about the extent to which the pagans viewed their gods and their myths as being literally real. And I found it very interesting as I read the history of paganism that while many people viewed their gods and the pagan myths as real, some of the elites, and especially the philosophers, and I'm thinking particularly of the Stoics, viewed the myths and the gods as metaphorical. For instance, Smith, in his book Pagans and Christians in the City, he refers to Cicero's description of the views of a Stoic philosopher named Quintus Lucilius Balbus. Balbus viewed the gods and myths as symbols and not as literal descriptions of real entities and events. But nevertheless, he argued that it was important to keep the metaphors alive. Here's a quote from Smith's book, and this is what Balbus is saying. Quote, "Behind these sacrilegious fables lies a scientific explanation which is quite sophisticated." Okay. So he's calling the myths sacrilegious fables. And he says behind them, though, there are scientific explanations. And he goes on to say, quote, though we reject these stories with contempt, we shall be able to identify and grasp the nature of the divinity pervading each and every natural habitat, as Ceres on Earth, as Neptune on the seas, and as other deities in other areas, and we shall acknowledge the significance of the names which custom has imposed on them. These are the deities which we are to revere and worship. Our worship of the gods is best and most chaste, most holy, and totally devout when we revere them with pure, sincere, and untainted hearts and tongues. End quote. So some philosophers, like Balbus the Stoic, they embrace the gods as being real, but only in a metaphorical sense, as revealing something deep and valuable, or even scientific, they use that term, about nature. But these pagan thinkers essentially rejected the idea that the gods were literally real and the myths about them described real events.
Yeah, Dan, that sounds a lot like Jordan Peterson attempting to answer the question, do you believe in God?
Yeah, indeed.
You know, he's... He definitely has that approach in those lectures that where he deals with that issue.
Yeah, he treats the Bible, but also all the other pagan myths as metaphors, as does his mentor, Carl Jung. Remember Carl Jung's archetypal approach to religious texts. And I'm just searching here for a clip. Maybe we can get a clip here from Peterson. Listen to this.
So these stories are trying to express what you might describe as an unchanging, transcendent reality. You know, it's something like what's common across all human experience across all time. And that's what Jung essentially meant by an archetype.
So this archetype, this abstraction.
And again, I would say that's a very deep idea. I think it's the most true idea I know.
Yeah, Dave.
All right. It was a good clip, but I think we got to put a moratorium on Peterson clips.
No more Peterson for now. Yeah. We'll save it.
The ISOs are okay, but I think
we're almost done with Peterson. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, before you move on, there's something that popped into my head here. I was listening to one of the great courses. This is a course that the Terror of History, Mystics, Heretics, Witches, and witches in the Western tradition. And there's a whole section here on the Enlightenment and how the Enlightenment brings in a bunch of the pagan worldview back into the Western consciousness. And he makes the point that the elites, for example, the elites were on about, they were all gaga over ideas about Hermeticism alchemy, and this stuff we'll get into a little bit later, but that was the elites. But the masses, for them, the reintroduction of paganism took the form of basically magic and witchcraft. And so there's what you're kind of describing here is maybe there's a difference, you know, the way the elites thought of things and the way the masses more superstitiously took things. Perhaps that distinction goes all the way back, you know, into ancient Rome.
Yeah. And Smith includes a great quote from the revered historian Edward Gibbon. And the quote goes as follows. The various modes of worship which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people as equally true, by the philosophers as equally false, and by the magistrates as equally useful. Right?
And maybe that's the note to end on.
Exactly. That, you know, people viewed it differently depending on their position in life. Yeah, Dave. So we've covered a lot of ground, but we're only scratching the surface of this topic of paganism. So in the next few episodes, I hope we can cover pagan views of what is sacred, pagan ideas of chaos and order, pagan views of sexuality and magic and witchcraft and alchemy and astrology and hermeticism and the occult and ecstatic practices. So there's lots to cover. I'm talking to the audience now. Make sure you stay tuned for future episodes of this podcast.
All right, so on the web, you can find us at notconform.show, and that's where you're going to find the individual episode pages and show notes and descriptions and subscribe links and embedded players to listen to online, all that kind of stuff. And the website is the best way to spread the word about the show. Just point them to notconform.show, and you can even just put a specific link to a specific episode or even a link to a specific clip in the episode. And we really rely on you guys to get the word out. We don't have an advertising budget. We don't have, you know, we're not like on YouTube or any of these other social media things. So we need you to get the word out, spread the word, notconform.show. And if you want to send us articles or feedback or anything like that, we really appreciate that. We love to hear from you. Send us an email at info@notconformed.show. So that's info@notconformed.show. Okay, Dan, that's it.
All right, Dave, I'll talk to you on the next episode.
See you then.